the hen hit me in the face the other day. We hunted for maybe 35 minutes on Sunday and we shot our two birds. They were whiskey got, I think, close to hypothermia last weekend. Her whole body was that way and she was just shaking, so I had to carry her back to the truck.
Are you all set up with pigeons and launchers and that kind of stuff? Or how do you go about it? Do you just kind of hunt your dogs? What do you do?
So my neighbor and I, 3 years ago, got into the pigeon trapping business. So we put an ad on Craigslist, free pigeon removal for farmers. And once it's dark out, you go up top, you throw a net over the hole, and then it's just free pickings.
Do you have a favorite shotgun?
I've switched to
Hey everyone, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Today we are joined by Isaiah Osborne. Thanks for joining me today on this pretty cold, wintry feeling day, buddy.
Yeah, negative 14 out, so a little cold, I'd say.
Is that what thermometer read for you this morning?
It was when I woke up this morning to go to the gym. Yeah, it was cold.
You hit the gym already. Good for you.
Oh, yeah, every morning.
That's every morning?
Yep.
What are you working on?
Maintaining. Try to... After the military, my body kind of took a toll, so I just try to stay limber, I guess, and be able to move. So I continue to hunt until my old age.
That's a good plan. I try to do the same, and I've gotten better at it over the years. So you got a head start on me, but keep it up.
It helps. My wife goes to the gym at 5 a.m., and then I get to sleep until like 6, and then she comes home, wakes me up, and then she's on baby duty, and then I go to the gym, so... It works out well.
I know you've got a little one. Is it, did she turn one yet?
Yeah, October 10th.
The article that you were featured in the Star Tribune mentioned she was 11 months old at the time. So it's been a little while since then.
The day before pheasant opener. I planned that one well.
Very nice plan. Yeah, it's fall birth, day before pheasant opener, which is right up your alley. So we'll talk about that and much more. I think when I came out to the garage this morning to let the dogs out, it was negative 11 here in Duluth. And you're a bit south of me. Listeners on the map, let us know where you are and just give a little background about yourself.
We're in New Ulm, Minnesota. Well, just outside New Ulm, Minnesota, Brown County, which is kind of the hub of pheasant hunting in Minnesota. So didn't grow up in a hunting family. Grew up with 9 siblings. I was the only one of the siblings that hunted. Some of my uncles hunted. I had a cousin who kind of took me under his wing, but he's big into waterfowl. He owns a waterfowl lodge out in South Dakota now. So pheasant hunting was kind of a thing. I don't know how I got into it. Me and my buddies just sometimes after we're football practice or after school, we'd jump in the trucks and drive around and see pheasants. So that sparked my interest. And then we started hunting from there and haven't looked back since.
Seeing we're recording on Riverside. I'm seeing deer in my rearview mirror here. we got deer on the back ridge. There's one right. I don't know if the listeners can, or if we can see. Oh, yeah, there it is. Yeah. They're cruising through. That's a daily occurrence here. We've got does and fawns pretty much back there every day. We have had some really nice bucks come through this year. That's obviously slowing down now, being that it's December. But how was your deer season this year? I know you were doing a little bit of that.
I try to get my deer hunting done before pheasant season starts. So I'm big into archery. I had a few target bucks this year, and they've all gave me a slip. I was within 15 yards of two of them, and never got it done. So then once pheasant season starts, it's brown, it's down. So I had a doe come into about 80 yards and shot her with the muzzle loader. So put the meat in the freezer, and we got back into the field pheasant hunting again. So it's kind of how it goes.
Was that muzzleloader season, or were you just
no,
using
that was
muzzleloader?
During gun season. Yeah.
Okay.
During
okay.
regular gun season, I use a muzzleloader.
What kind of muzzleloader do you have?
I don't have one.
Oh.
I use my buddy's. Okay. It's a CVA muzzleloader. It's the first year I've shot since I was 12 with a gun. Otherwise, it's been bow only.
Yeah, I only ask because I've never really thought about muzzle loading, but it's really the weather, like the snow and stuff. I was watching buck tracking videos and thinking about later season stuff, like if I'm not chasing grouse, what else could I occupy myself with? So I kind of went down a little muzzle loader rabbit hole last week during the Thanksgiving holiday, and I was asking some friends about them. So
what'd you conclude with that CVA?
I actually know somebody that is connected with CVA. So they were one of the first companies that I looked at, and I kind of was looking at some models. I didn't buy anything yet, but I may have an opportunity to do so. It's kind of like I'm not going to do anything this year. So it might be one of those things that maybe pass this year in a couple of weeks, but I am thinking about adding one to the arsenal just to those later season opportunities to get out there and go for a walk in the woods and do something with it. So I may do something yet, but I haven't. You're on the show today really because thanks to my mom, because she's always done this. Anytime she sees an article in like the Duluth paper or the Minneapolis Star Tribune about bird hunting, she basically saves it for me and gives it to me. And she mentioned the article that was featured you because you grew up pheasant hunting a little bit, as you kind of alluded to already, without a bird dog. And you've since gone on, done a bunch of other stuff, including serving the Marine Corps. Thank you for your service. And you now have bird dogs. And you were commenting about how it's kind of like, it was a real eye opener to go back and hunt some of those same places with bird dogs. And I've had a very similar experience with ruffed grouse. Grew up hunting grouse without a dog. Now I have my dogs, and the listeners know all about that. But I just thought it was really cool and reached out to you. And again, excited to have you on the show today. But I want to learn a little bit more about kind of your journey through the Marine Corps. Specifically, you ended up in Arizona and you got connected with a dog trainer down there. Like, how did the dots connect? And I guess before you go into that, did you always think someday I'm going to get a bird dog, or was that something that kind of came later on?
Yeah. So like I said, I'm from a big family. There's 9 of us kids, and Dad never let us have a dog or a cat or anything. We could have hamsters and fish. That's about it. So he always said, when you get out, you can have as many dogs as you want. And I always thought I'd be a lab guy. My uncles bred labs, so they're all big into waterfowl. And they have offered me labs growing up my whole life. And my dad kept saying, no, I'm allergic. I can't do this. You can't do that. So I always thought I was going to be a lab guy. Fast forward, I graduated high school. They didn't know what I was going to do. So I joined the Marine Corps. And like you said, I was stationed down in Arizona. There's a really small unit in the Marine Corps. It's disbanded now, but it was Yuma Search and Rescue. So there was about 4 of us crew chiefs that were in the helicopter. There's 2 pilots and then a crew chief, a Marine Corps crew chief, and a Navy corpsman on the other side of the helicopter. And yeah, we would fly around and do missions within 100 nautical miles of Yuma, Arizona. It would range from helping Border Patrol, helping Yuma County Sheriff's Office, and then Yuma, Arizona is one of the biggest air training stations. So there's a lot of aviation mishap type things that would happen. So we did that, and then COVID struck. And kind of like everyone else, even the Marine Corps kind of settled down a little bit, and Yuma SAR was getting shut down at that time. So I was switching over to a different job, and that job was much easier. And I had a little bit more free time. So my wife and I, we had 2 dogs, an Australian cattle dog and a little mutt thing. And me and my buddy Jeff Stone, we got into waterfowl down there a little bit. And
oh really, what kind of waterfowl opportunities are down there?
Endless. It's insane.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, it's Mexican ducks, cinnamon teal, bunch of mallards. We killed a snow goose once.
Wow.
You go over by the Phoenix area and you're able to shoot a bunch of geese coming out of the golf courses out in the ag fields just outside Phoenix.
No kidding.
The huge sandhill crane migration comes down to like the Tucson area, the southeast area. There's a huge sandhill crane migration that there's a lot of opportunity there. But yeah, so we're into that. We were walking into the ponds in the Colorado River, and we'd flush quail, and we're like, okay, this is something new. So we started hunting quail again without bird dogs, which kind of helps you in Arizona with some of those gambles. Quail without a bird dog, it's sometimes a little easier to hunt. But we watched videos, and we were like, this would be sweet to do with a pointing dog. So I was Googling, finding it out, and I found Rashawn Gordon of Gordon's Gun Dogs down in Arizona. Him and his wife, Melissa, run that. And I reached out to him, and I said, hey, I'm in the Marine Corps. I don't have a dog, but I'd love to see your dogs. Try to understand how it works with quail. And he took me under his wing after day one, and we started a training session. We'd have a bunch of people who had bird dogs in the local area, a lot of military guys, a lot of Border Patrol guys, would come out Sunday mornings, and Rashawn had a flight pen full of chuckers, quail. And so we started a training session, I guess you'd say, in the morning. And
yeah, kind of a weekly gathering of bird dog guys and girls. Yeah.
And he would always lend me out dogs. So he had probably 20 short hairs that he had and probably 5 Britneys. So whatever one I was feeling that week, we'd take out and run during the week because COVID. So we could hunt pretty much all week. And so at the end of that, he told me pick a male and a female and he'll breed them. And I could pick out my puppy, and I picked Zona.
And Zona is a short hair, right?
Yeah, I have
okay.
2 German short hairs for hunting dogs. I have Zona and Whiskey.
Okay. Is Whiskey from Gordon's Gun Dogs as well?
Whiskey's actually from, after Zona, I got a dog named Ellie. And we bred Ellie 2 years ago, and that's where Whiskey came out of. But Ellie and Zona, 2 females in the household, always thought they're the head of the house, and we had the daughter come in. So I didn't want dogs fighting with my little daughter around, so Ellie moved over to Ohio. She's living a good life over there. So
interesting. Yeah. So a couple things. You mentioned so you first started hunting the scaled quail without a dog. What makes it now? I don't gamble quail. Okay. So I've never hunted them. I've heard bits and pieces about them, I guess, from guests and just from the things that I read and watch and stuff. But I know desert quail can be runners. What makes them easier about, like, do they just really want to run away from the dogs, or what makes them easier without a dog sometimes?
Well, we started hunting them kind of like how some of the people hunt grouse up in the Northwoods. They drive around on side-by-sides. We just bomb around the desert in our trucks, and we'd see a covey of quail run across, and we'd jump out of the trucks and walk over there and bust the covey, and then we'd go hunt singles after that. Once they sit down, once a covey busts, they sit down in a little cactus or something like that, and you're able to just go over and flush singles. And
you can kind of see where they're ending up. Yeah, okay. Get straight to the chase a little bit.
Then having to get a dog out, put a dog out, and then the dog goes, flushes them. Which is more, we enjoyed it more with dogs.
Yeah.
We shot less birds, but it was more enjoyable. We were able to do the same thing, get out, flush the covey. But then we'd let the dogs out once their covey's flushed, and we'd go hunt singles in that area for a while. And there's still a lot of moving around. So it's not like pheasant hunting where you get out and you walk a big area. We'd drive around in the truck and we'd see a covey, we'd flush it, and then we'd let dogs out, hunt them, and then go back into the truck and keep going.
Interesting, because I think that's pretty common. I mean, a lot of people find that. I know for me it was, I developed a certain way of hunting grouse without dogs that was relatively effective, I would say, like as far as shooting opportunities. And then when I got my first bird dog, like the shooting opportunities definitely decreased right away, just because, I mean, you're learning a lot of stuff and you got to figure a lot of stuff out about the dog. So it's kind of natural, but then there's just, moving in on points and shooting birds on the wing and all that sort of stuff that you got to sort of put the pieces together. I mean, now, like, I'm a way more effective hunter with my dogs than I ever was without. But when it comes to, like, just those strictly shooting opportunities, I feel like sometimes people that hunt without dogs on foot, you'll hear that. And I've heard that before and kind of had a similar experience. So I always find that interesting. But I think the vast majority of people would say what you said, which is that just
the sheer enjoyment of hunting with dogs kind of outweighs any of that stuff if you stick with it.
Yeah, I agree. Same thing with pheasant hunting up here. I mean, it was fun with me and my buddies in high school running around, and we'd walk pretty much just edges of property and go to key in big clumps of grass or wooded lots or little willow patches and stuff, and we'd shoot onesie twosies, which was fun. But as you alluded to earlier, putting the bird dogs on the ground, and it helps with GPS now. The first year I moved home, I didn't have GPS, so it was a lot of just running after the bird dogs, trying to keep up with them, and they'd flush them because they were new birds and they didn't know what they're doing. But with the addition of GPS collars and older dogs, I guess you could say, it's a lot more enjoyable. It's relaxing finally, and it's fun again.
The listeners know I don't really have very much experience at all hunting pheasants, a few trips here and there over the years, but I would just based on what I know, like just knowing how tight they can hold in thick cover, I'd feel like it would be pretty hard to flush a lot of them without a dog. But like what sort of tips and tricks, you know, you mentioned a couple there, but like how you're going for a walk, obviously, and you're seeing what you can kick up. But I mean, what would you do to try to stack the odds in your favor?
Without bird dogs?
Yeah, without bird dogs.
Had as many friends in the field as we could.
Yeah.
And push just to the edges, because a lot of times you just push from one corner to the other corner and you wouldn't see a bird till the last 20 yards of the field.
Yeah.
And then they have nowhere else to go and they just popcorn flush out. And that was pretty much it. Always just put a lot of miles on and kick everything that a pheasant, you think a pheasant could hide underneath, and
right,
put a lot of miles on.
Yeah, that makes sense. So now, like, you can go out with just yourself and a bird dog and feel like you can kind of confidently find more birds, probably.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's night and day difference now. I'm thinking about back to when we didn't have bird dogs, the amount of birds we probably walked over that were just hiding tight. And even with the dogs, now you can see that the pheasants a lot of times will run out in front of you and then try to circle back behind you. Because a lot of the times my dogs will be out working in front and then they kick back over to my right or my left. I'm like, oh, they're supposed to be hunting in front of me when I first got bird dogs. But I was like, so when I first got them, I was like, no, keep going. And now I allow them to be able to circle back behind me, because a lot of the times once they get back behind me slightly to the right or left or whatever, they lock on point and they're pinning their bird down in between me and the dog. So just allowing the dogs to be able to use their nose a little bit more and have the confidence that they know what they're doing.
It makes perfect sense. Obviously, we don't have the nose that the bird dogs do, and we don't cover as much ground. It's like, if anything, that it just shows you, it really highlights how many birds you were walking past and around without dogs.
I started hunting dogs singles, and I've heard on a podcast a long time ago, there's such thing as tracking dogs and true dogs. And I haven't, this year has been the first year that I've actually been able to see that. I have Zona, who's a true dog. She locks up on scent. I can pick her up, move her, like, come on, let's go. There's no bird here. And then Whiskey, she'll come in, lock up behind Zona, and then she just starts tracking the pheasants. So having the combination of the two dogs, I always have to hunt them together now, because I feel like if I don't, I'm going to miss a bird here or there. So
yeah.
I always have those two, and it works out very well. Sometimes Whiskey will break off on a track, and I follow Whiskey, and there's no bird. I come back to Zona, who's still on point, and the bird held tight. So it's, I think with pheasant hunting, you kind of need both of those dogs. One won't find all the birds, and the other one will bust birds. Whiskey sometimes hurts us. She'll fly up and bust birds, but it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Now, that the tracking and true, that I recall that from, I've interviewed Kyle Warren. I think he coined the true dog tracking dog thing. I guess I don't know that for a 100% fact, but it's the way he describes it, and I've talked to him about it. I know my buddy Nick Adair interviewed him as well, and we've talked about that at length. And I have two dogs that are, they're similar. Like, Kyle would describe my one dog that I think has more tracking tendency. I think Kyle would describe her as, he had a way of saying, like, a cold nosed true dog or something like that, which I'm forgetting now, but she definitely tracks
stocks more than my other dog, who's kind of like your cookie cutter true dog, if you will. Talking the apples to apples here, but it is really interesting to watch those two different styles. Now, do you feel like it was pretty much just innate, like one dog versus you didn't do anything to bring that out of them? It was just like they go about their business in different ways,
essentially bred in genetically. Because Whiskey's mom Ellie was the exact same way. She was my first tracking dog, which caused me a lot of pain thinking that I was a really bad dog trainer. because
you didn't know what was going on exactly.
Right. And she would just keep bumping birds, even with planted birds. It's like, what am I doing wrong? Like, I'm watching the videos, I'm doing this. I talked to Rashawn. She showed me all this. And now with Whiskey, I think after those podcasts listening to that, I was like, okay, we just need to come at this at a different angle. And so I started to study her up a little bit more. I put multiple birds inside of small area with launchers, and that's how I got her at least somewhat steady in the beginning. Is she'd run flush one, I'd pop another one, and whoa her as we're doing that. So that steadied her up a little bit. But with pheasants, I don't want her to really be doing that anymore. I like what she's doing, and it's working well for pheasants. So because they run,
she's the tracker, and you want her sticking with the birds now.
Yeah, absolutely. It's helped a lot.
Again, very, very similar. And I'm sure we've talked about it on the show at some point, whether I was talking to Kyle or somebody else, but it really helped me just a way to look at the dogs and understand what I was seeing, and to allow my dog Rose, who's more of a tracker, to do her. I mean, she follows birds distances that I see it every year, and it just amazes me. And, you know, sometimes I do wonder, I think I have a pretty good handle on it, but sometimes I wonder if, you know, she's so cautious in how she tracks and follows birds. Like, I wonder, do the birds, and I don't know the answer to this, but are the birds more inclined to run because she's so cautious? Whereas, because you'll hear people say, if a dog comes up on a bird real fast, it'll freeze that bird and pin it, right? I don't know if I would, I couldn't say with confidence that that's the case, just because Rose, she produces more bird contacts just in general. And I think it is that, like, her relentless pursuit of a running bird that really wants to run, she'll stick with it and eventually we'll put that bird up. Now, there's other things going on with my two dogs. It's always a small sample size, right? She's a younger dog. She covers more ground. Hartley's slowing down. He's 11 years old. So it's hard to say exactly, but over the course of Rose's life, I was also a much better hunter and bird dog handler when I got Rose. She's my second dog, right? So that's, you and I are similar in that way, where we're just kind of getting started in this whole thing. But I've learned a ton in the last 11 years. So I've put Rose on a lot more birds early on than I did Hartley too. But just those little stylistic differences are, I mean, they're fun to talk about, if nothing else, but it's a lot of fun to see it play out in the field too.
Yeah, I can say I definitely have a lot more false points over Zona than Whiskey, because Zona, if she smells anything, she locks up. Whiskey, she's able to tell if it's new, old scent. I think that's what's going on. She smells, and then she's able to track the birds, and she's been doing a lot better now with the snow because the birds are holding tighter. So they'll run a little bit, and then they'll hunker down, and then she locks up again. So she's doing a little bit better of slightly moving slower and not just flushing every bird. But when she's on point, you know there's a bird in front of her because it's not moving and she's not moving. So it's a fun feeling.
Yeah. So what's the give you the kind of the pheasant report so far this season? And obviously it was anybody in the region kind of knows, like, I think this is pretty widespread too. I mean, it was such a mild November all the way up until last Tuesday. Then we had this winter storm come in, and it's like, I mean, it's flipped on its head at this point. But what was the pheasant season like up to that point? And now what have you been seeing if you've been out since the snow?
So early season, a lot of running birds, but there's birds everywhere. So it was a really fun season. We did a lot in, like, the, I don't know, Comfrey area, more a little bit west of New Ulm. And the bird population there was higher than we've ever seen. It was birds everywhere, good for a younger dog. And now since the snow, we were now during the blizzard on Tuesday, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday that we got the snow here, and then Sunday, and now the birds are holding tighter than I'll get out. I had my GoPro on Sunday, and I had a hen rooster or a hen pheasant hit my face flushing.
It was really,
it's a pretty funny video. I was like, she just hit me in the face. So yeah, it's been good. Earlier in the season, it was kind of dry for a little bit, so I had a lot of Whiskey's eyes were all getting cut up, and she has a little bit more droopy eyelids than Zona. So I had to rinse her eyelids out multiple times during the field because she kept getting seeds in her eyes and everything, but made scenting conditions a little bit tough. And then we got a little bit of rain, and then now we got the snow, and it's just been lights out since. So
yeah, it was really dry. I think I want to say Duluth had like a record low rainfall in October, and we didn't get much in November up until last week when we got two different kind of snow events now. But yeah, it was dry. It was tough. Like, it was just like spots that you were flushing a lot of birds in the last couple of years. It was way more hit and miss this year. And I think a lot of people that hunted Great Lakes region kind of experienced that to varying degrees, I guess. But the conditions in November made up for it a lot, as far as just like having really good days in the woods. And we had some productive hunts. We had some of our best hunts in November, so that kind of helped. I mean, I feel like I was able to really take advantage of the good grouse hunting conditions, because now just with full snow coverage and everything changes in the grouse woods, not so much for pheasant hunting, or it's a different effect, I guess. That's kind of a thing with pheasants, right? When the snow flies, do they start to hold tighter? I feel like I've heard that.
A lot of people don't even start pheasant hunting until the snow falls, because the birds are running nonstop. But once the snow falls, it's a whole different game, and it's the birds hold so tight. Like I said, the hen hit me in the face the other day. We hunted for maybe 35 minutes on Sunday, and we shot our two birds. I had to kick them out of the snow banks to get them out. So it makes it a lot easier.
Do you know why that is, or like what the theory is why they hold tighter?
I assume they just can't run as fast through the snow. So they assume that if they hunker down and they feel like they aren't seen, because they like they're where the birds are flushing out of, it's just a little hole where a grass has fell over and then snow piles on top. So so they're down in there. Whiskey went on point, and her nose was inside the hole. I was like, oh, they love killing raccoons. And we were right on the slough edge. I was like, here we go, we're gonna have to fight a raccoon. And so I went in and pulled her back, which I don't know, good or bad. I'm always weary on the side of I don't want a raccoon fight. So I pulled her back, and I walked in, and the rooster flushed right there. I was like, oh, sorry, Whiskey, but
you never know.
Yeah. We've had too many raccoon fights and killing skunks that I always pull them back on those little things.
that is not something that I've ever really had to deal with my setters and in the grouse woods. I've definitely heard about it with more pheasant hunting, and you just never know what's hiding in that grass, I guess.
Yeah, it's especially when the snow falls and it's all matted down. Those raccoons and skunks love burrowing under, just like the raccoons or just like the pheasants do. So
right,
it's hit or miss what's going to come out, especially in the cattail. So
this is not my wheelhouse, but it's like a two rooster limit, but then doesn't it go to three in December or something, or is that not a thing anymore?
December 1st it switches over to three roosters. So from October 11th to December, or to the end of November, it's two. December 1st to the end of the season is three. And I don't know the reason because of that. I think it's just to get more roosters off the landscape so the hens have a better chance of surviving through the winter. That's what I was always told, but I don't know how true that is. But it makes sense, because they'll be out there fighting for food, and if you have a really bad winter, foods and habitats are the two biggest things that pheasants need. So if you get some of the roosters out, it allows the hens to be able to survive longer and hopefully have chicks in the next year. And it doesn't take that many roosters to create more pheasants next year, but you need the hens. So that's just what I was open told.
I think I remember reading when they did that, because I don't think it was that long ago that they changed that. But I guess it would be an interesting question to ask a pheasant biologist, because that makes sense. But obviously there's some reasoning behind it. But again, not my expertise. growing up in Minnesota, now you grew up in pheasant country, but do you ever go north and chase rough grouse?
I've never done it.
Never done it.
No. Nope. I go west or south or west. I've never gone up to the Northwoods. I mean, we've been to Duluth growing up as kids, but maybe once or twice. We don't go north, more north than like Painesville area, because that's where some of my uncles have some lake houses, and we go fishing up in that area. But I don't explore the north much. But I'd like to change that.
Again, so you and I have that in common, because it's like, I don't live very far from pheasant country, but I rarely, if ever, get down there to chase them. So I certainly understand that. You know, you obviously love chasing pheasants on your home turf, as I love chasing grouse up here. But it sounds like both of us have like a whole world of opportunity we could go explore.
Some of my family went to school up in Ely, and they're like, come up, it's insane. I think this is 2 years ago, and they're like, come up here, bring your dogs up. Like, yeah, but the pheasant hunting's good, so why would I drive 4 hours north when I could just drive 10 minutes outside my house and go kill birds? So it would be something cool to do.
We'll have to do a hunt swap one of these years. And really, if I'm being totally honest, like, this is the year where, you know, when the snow flew last week, I mean, like I said, I really felt like I was able to take advantage of the really good hunting. Now I'm kind of just, we sort of hit pause last week, Thanksgiving holiday, and I was thinking about deer hunting a little bit. I never did get out, but we've just been getting caught up in the office and kind of brainstorming a little bit about what might be next. But this is really the year that I've been talking about where I probably need to get maybe some travel trips on the calendar. We got a couple, couple months here to go. I don't have any big trips planned yet, but it's sort of an open book at this point, because I don't know how many more times we'll be in the grouse woods. We'll probably get out again. I'm going to wait until it's not 11 degrees below zero, but there'll be a nice enough day where we'll go for a walk. But it's winter now, so we got to figure that out.
Load the truck up and drive down here. I'm hunting every day, not today because it's too cold, but the rest of the week until Monday. So I have a buddy from the Navy coming over from Chicago tonight, and nice. Him and I will just be hitting the birds. So jump in the truck and drive down. We got a house that you can stay in and kennels for dogs. So
kind of sounds like fun to me. I appreciate the invite.
Bring it.
What's an ideal pheasant day look like for you? I mean, little breeze, obviously, not frozen, but you can kind of get out there and get after it. Like, it doesn't, even when it's cold, this total switch to winter has been, it was abrupt, but it's like, you get out there and you go for a hike, you get heated up, you can still enjoy yourself out there in the cold temp. So we've been getting our exercise runs in, but what is a ideal pheasant hunting day look like for you this time of year?
This time of year, I like probably like 15 to 20 degrees with probably a 10 to 15 mile an hour wind. That way the birds can't hear you coming, because if you've ever looked at a pheasant's ear, they're huge. They can hear you coming from a long ways away. So I like being able to have that wind in my face. It makes it a little bit more cold, but it is what it is. And snow. I love the snow. I don't like 2 feet of snow but this soft, fluffy snow that we got, it's amazing. It doesn't wreck the dog's feet, because once we get a little bit of ice on top of the snow and it's that crunchy snow, the dog's nail beds are bleeding the whole time, and it makes it way harder for them to bust through the snow. But fluffy snow, 15 to 20 degrees and nice little breeze is the perfect day. Sun shining, of course.
You like the sun shining?
Yes.
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, who doesn't? But so there's sometimes, like a overcast day is good for visibility. But
yeah, I haven't noticed a big difference between a sunny day and a cloudy day affecting a pheasant hunt at all. It's just more enjoyable when the sun's shining for me. So
that has been like almost a silver lining, if you will, that like it's hard to believe, because I mean, the day before the storm, it was 50 degrees here in Duluth. It was almost like too hot. I went out grouse hunting and I mean, I was warm. But then the temperatures dropped, and we haven't been back above freezing since the snow flew, which, to your point, has kept the snow really nice and fluffy. I was thinking about it last night, because it got below zero for the first time, and I don't know that we have the kind of snow that the rough grouse are like diving into and snow roosting, but it's there's enough snow, fluffy snow out there that I imagine they had pretty good insulation, decent conditions to sort of weather some of this cold snap. And it's going to warm up again tomorrow. Like tomorrow's probably going to be a pretty nice day for you.
20 to 25 with a good wind. Yeah, it'll be a perfect day for pheasant hunting all day tomorrow. So, and now at the limit, like you said, switching to three, and there'll be a couple of us. It'll be a full day in the field of running bird dogs. So,
do you find that as the season progresses, I mean, we already talked about they can hold tighter with the snow. I mean, do the birds get harder to hunt, jumpier, a little bit more weary as the season goes on, or do you not really notice that much?
For sure, until the snow falls. So like November, they were jumping out at 100 yards. Dog would go on point. Pheasant would flush at 100 yards because they just take off running. They can hear you, see you, whatever. Once the snow falls, it changes back a little bit. That's like a lot of people don't start pheasant hunting until the snow falls. They kind of get dumb again once that first snowfall happens. And they're easier to hunt again. But come mid-December, they'll start running again once they have their tracks all throughout the cattails. Because you walk into a cattail so you can see they have tracks or trails matted down. And they're running again. But yeah.
What kind of stuff are you looking for as far as like cattail sloughs, other types of wood lines? Like what are some of the main objectives that you're trying to hunt right now?
Yeah, I hunt a lot of creek edges where there's tall grass, and with the snow it all gets matted down like I was talking about. A lot of willow patches. Those are really fun to hunt sometimes when there's 15, 20 birds all bunched up in there. It's like a covey rise of quail, but big old roosters flushing out of there because they all just bunch up in there when it's real cold to block the wind. And a lot of wood lines, actually, so like tree rows or like evergreen lines, field or windbreaks. We'll walk a lot of, not field edges, but edges of CRP fields that have evergreens, and they'll be bunched up under those as well, which sometimes makes it harder, which is in the winter, they like to bunch up into groups. They're not all spread out throughout the fields. They're always generally in groups of 5 to 10, it seems like, later in the season. So more eyes always makes it more harder to hunt.
If you do you have a favorite time of day to hunt pheasants? Is it golden hour, or do you like mornings, afternoons?
Generally, I like to get out in the morning, but the best time to kill birds is definitely golden hour. Like Sunday, I went out and I watched the birds sit in the field feeding. I got out at about 3, and I had to sit there for an hour because they were just out feeding till about 4. Then they all flew back into the grass, and then I finally let the dogs out. We were able to hunt for the last like 40 minutes. But the golden hour is easy. You can drive around with the snow now. You can see them out feeding in fields, so you can just sit there and watch them till they go back into the grass and hunker down for the night, and then you're able to get in there.
The other thing that you did earlier, I think earlier this year, you went on your first sharptail grouse hunt, like out-of-state sharptail hunt.
We went last year, and then we went this year as well. Yeah. So last year I did the camp with Tyler, and yeah, stayed at, because we figured we might as well just do the camp, have Tyler show us around, show us what to look for. We've never been out there before. And then this year we just went out and we camped relatively in the same area, but we just camping $20 for 4 days or whatever it was. We set up a tent and just did it on our own. So yeah, it was good. I brought someone who's never hunted out there before, my neighbor. He got a little cocker, and we went out, and it rained pretty much every day, and we were sleeping in a tent, which wasn't the best. I think it was
not
a tent
ideal.
Tent from like the 60s, a wax canvas tent. And the day before, we went to Walmart and we bought DWR spray and sprayed it all down and hoped, and everything was still wet. Yeah.
Yeah. Were you out there during like I feel like there was like a bunch of tornadoes and stuff and some kind of crazy weather. Were you out there for that?
Yeah. So there's a big tornadoes the week before we went out. And then when we were there, there's a tornado like 30 miles north of us, I believe, right by the Canadian border. And yeah, it was nonstop storm, so it was a little bit sketchy, but I think it kind of made the birds hold a little bit tighter, which sharptails already hold tight, but it was a lot of miles on the truck. Birds were kind of far and few between compared to last year. Last year, we were shoot our Huns and Sharpies by 10:30, 11 o'clock, and This year we had to hunt in the morning and the afternoon to maybe shoot a few sharpies, but it's still awesome to get out there in that landscape and be able to walk forever and see the dogs forever.
Yeah, especially that time of year. I mean, you can't hunt pheasants that time of year, and the ruffed grouse woods are not as fun of a place to be that time of year. So to go out there and stretch your legs and see that country, it's a lot of fun, and different birds too, obviously. How are you feeling as far as like getting the sharp tails kind of figured out after a couple of years of hunting them?
Pretty good now. The first year we didn't know what we were doing. Like I said, we had Tyler show us around. You look for the berry patches and grass that a volleyball hides in, essentially. And this year, like I said, it was harder because there wasn't as many birds, but we still were able to find birds compared to some of the people we were talking to who would get skunked every day. I don't think we got skunked once. So I felt confident going out there. It was pretty much me guiding someone who's never been out there either. And we got into birds every day and shot our limit 2 days. So it was good.
As a pheasant hunter, do you have to kind of stop yourself from wanting to hunt heavier cover? Like, cause that's the one thing, like, and Tyler will always say it, like, if you're looking at pheasant cover, that's not sharp tail cover, but obviously you got some mentoring from Tyler that first year. So you maybe got going on the right path.
Yeah. He showed us, I think the first day we were out there, we went hunting with Tyler and he showed us exactly what to look for. And then we were on our own after that. But yeah, I don't think so. I mean, from going and hunting the desert birds too, I was pretty used to hunting in open
short
areas.
Yeah.
So I think it was pretty similar, I would say.
It's a lot of fun, and just again watching the dogs run through the short grass is a blast, especially in September. So I'll be looking forward to that.
The hardest thing for me is my pheasant dogs generally stay within 100 yards. And when I get out there, I'm just like, go further, keep going. Don't look back at me. Don't come back to me. That's the only thing I think that I struggle with when I go out there, is just wanting the dogs to go further. But it'll come with time. This is only their first and second time going out there. So they'll start figuring it out more and more.
Do you feel like do you kind of keep your dogs in that pocket for pheasant hunting, or is their range pretty natural?
When they're younger, I try to keep them in closer just so they get that in their mind, because when I first moved back, it was kind of hunting them like flushers, because they went from living in the desert to moving up to Minnesota and hunting in the snow, and they just could run forever down in the desert and came up here and they'd be flushing pheasants because they didn't know what they were doing. So I try to keep them within 100 yards pheasant hunting. And it's natural. Once their snow falls and we're hunting thicker cover, they stay within maybe 40, 50 yards. Like, just they move slower. So I think it's just kind of, they move at their own pace, but they generally know not to go too far. Unless Whiskey is tracking a bird and goes 300 yards and then I see it flying away.
Yeah. And just, I mean, with some of the stuff you've said and like what I understand, like just knowing how tight a pheasant could hold, you could see how, you know, having your dog stick a little bit closer and work the ground a bit more thoroughly versus making huge casts and covering grounds looking for birds that are more spread out, that would make sense for pheasant dogs.
Yeah. At early season though, I still want them out in that 100-yard range going out there and finding them, because those birds will run, and you can see a lot of times when they make a big loop, they'll be tracking a bird towards me, and then I don't know if the pheasant hears me walking one way and the dog coming the other way, they'll hunker down.
Yeah.
And they've been doing a lot of that early season, which is crazy to see that they can figure out how to pin a bird between me and them without any like training or anything. Because I can't train a dog to run out and bring a bird to me. That's
right. Yeah.
They naturally figure it out.
Especially if you have the tracking dogs, right? Like when they stick with a bird for a while and you kind of can get that visual of like where this bird is running, because, you know, it's just amazing. They move through that cover and like you don't know where they are. But when your dog can kind of show you the path, or at least like generally where it went, I mean, it's amazing to see that happen. And then whether it's by coincidence or the dog's really doing it, you know, like the right way on that specific bird, when you get that bird in between you and the dog, that's the sweet spot.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Also, either not in between us, but you can see them. The dog kind of goes on point. You get an alert and it moves. With a pheasant, a lot of the season, once they get to like a thicker edge or any break in the cover, That's also where the pheasants will hunker down. So it's cool to see that they're able to track the bird till it actually sits down.
So two short hairs. Now, I guess going back to the time that you spent with Rashawn down in Arizona, like, do you have a bird training? Like, are you all set up with pigeons and launchers and that kind of stuff? Or how do you go about it? Do you just kind of hunt your dog? What do you do?
Yeah. So my neighbor and I, 3 years ago, got into the pigeon trapping business. So we put an ad on Craigslist, free pigeon removal for farmers, and we actually get quite a few hits on that. So in the spring, that's what we do. We go around to empty grain bins, our grain silos, and if the top's open, we go up top. Once it's dark out, you go up top, you throw a net over the hole, and then it's just free pickings then. So we generally have endless supply of pigeons. We have a loft at his house. It's an old grain bin setup that we put a door on, and we're able to store probably 100 pigeons in there, but we don't keep homers or anything. We just have kill pigeons. It's just easier for us because we have a lot of pigeons around the New Ulm area that we have. We have a lot of dairies and a lot of people cut silage and stuff, so there's always pigeons around to get.
Awesome. So for anybody listening, if they're looking for pigeons in the spring, they got to call you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Heck yeah.
We've brought them down to Iowa. And then there's quite a few lab guys around here that do, that have kennels. So you sell a lot, 100 to 200 at a time, generally, pigeons. So it's easier than raising chucker or keeping homers for us. I mean, homers are good. We have our Key City Conservation Club over by Mankato area.
Okay.
I don't know if they still do it. I know there's some controversy over there, but from when I moved back till I think this year for sure, there's homers over there that you could go use in a big field. And so I'd always go over there and do training over there too with homers, it was a great asset moving home and not having Rashawn's set up for me to be able to go train birds at. It was nice to be able to have somewhere I could go have homers. They had launchers. I had my own launchers and go over there and just work birds.
Is most of your pheasant hunting are you hunting public land? Do you have private land access? How does that shake out for you, I guess?
Yeah, it's a mix between both. Growing up in the area, I know quite a few of the farmers. I worked at a precision ag company all throughout high school, so I'd go out and soil sample fields. So I met a lot of farmers that way. And so I have a few of my prime spots that I save for like when my dad comes out with me, and because I'm trying to get him into the uplands a little bit more. He started deer hunting when I was 12. And then now he's full into pheasants, but he's getting older and can't really do it too well. So
does he still have the no dog rule?
Yeah, he does not like dogs. So, but he likes watching them hunt. So that's good. But yeah, a lot of state property. That's
okay.
What I grew up hunting. And that's what I still do. I mean, I've expanded my reach a little bit more when I first was in high school. We'd stick around Brown County.
Yeah.
Which there's a lot of state land here in Brown County. But if you go further west, southwest, down the Nobles County region, that's where I spend a lot of time now, is on those state lands down there.
That's similar. You know, when I was younger, I kind of hunt the same places over and over again, and not hunting them as thoroughly as I do with dogs now. And so that's honestly, it's half the fun, or maybe even more than half the fun, is just like going out and finding a new spot to hunt, like expanding my territory and cutting the dogs loose somewhere and going to find a new place. I really enjoy that. It's kind of that adventure part of it.
When I bring people pheasant hunting with me, I always have Onyx pull up on my dash, and I'll be like, you want to see how far I expand in Minnesota? I zoom out and it's just one blob of just pins everywhere. They're like, you've hunted all those? I'm like, yeah, I always try to go find at least one new place all the time. So pins everywhere on my Onyx maps.
Mine too. And I imagine same for a lot of the listeners. That's a great resource for kind of leaving those breadcrumbs and sort of mapping out the territory and just keeping a catalog of places to go hunt. I mean, I love pulling up Onyx and just kind of looking like, oh, where haven't I hunted yet this year? I love returning to places like year after year, going back and kind of like doing an annual hunt at a certain spot. That's a lot of fun. And then, like you said, mixing in, I always got to have that sort of, what's the next one? We're finding that new spot to add to the to the library.
That's a big difference from when I was in high school versus now. We in high school, we literally just drive around until we saw the yellow state land signs, and then we'd jump out and start hunting them. Now it's just like, well, I can sit in my chair, drink coffee, let the dogs out, and see where I'm going to hunt today, and go drive there. And it's a game changer for me moving back home.
Yeah, definitely. Well, are you? Do you think you're a short haired guy for life, or does Rashawn have you thinking about Brittany's? What else?
Not Brittany's.
Not Brittany's.
No. He had one Jack. His name was Jack, and he turned me off Brittany's my whole life. Dog was just crazy and was a psychotic dog. But I'm thinking about going away from the German. Always wanting to kill everything. My wife and I were talking about an English setter next, but we don't know because we're going to breed, we're breeding Zona this spring. So I was thinking about keeping a puppy out of that, but we're torn now because we've been looking at setters, but I don't know. I've not a lot of people around my area run setters on pheasants, so it'd be a whole new territory for me. I don't know. I'm not set on short hairs for sure by any means. His whiskey got, I think, close to hypothermia last weekend. She fell through a cattail slough and got cold. And when a dog's mad, the tuft goes up. Her whole body was that way and she was just shaking. So I had to carry her back to the truck. So then that was getting my mind on maybe a wire hair, something a little bit more hardy for the winter. But I don't know. The two work for me well right now. I think three is a good number because that's what I had before. And it was always nice to be able to rotate dogs when one got hurt or something like that. Just still have those two dogs out there. But yeah, I don't know.
How old are Zona and Whiskey now?
Zona's 5 and Whiskey is 2.5.
You got a lot of hunting ahead with them. But
I don't know. Like I said, three is a good number for me, I think. And it... perfect kennel setup in the back of the truck. I have 3 kennels back there. I'm just look at it all the time. I'm like, I need to fill that kennel. I need to fill it. My wife's like, we have 4 dogs. You don't need 5 right now. I'm like, no, I do need 5. My dad told me I couldn't, so now I want 5.
What kind of truck and kennels do you have?
I have a 2023 F-150 with a topper.
Okay.
And I have 3 ruffling kennels across the back and fits perfectly inside there.
Are they intermediate rufflings?
Intermediate, yeah.
Okay.
Before I had the deck system, they wouldn't fit because the wheel wells, I put the deck system in and now I can fit 3 straight across the back. And then I have windows on the side of my topper. So I'm able to have access and storage behind the back and then the drawers. So it's still endless storage and it works very well.
You got deck system, you got kennels up front, like right where you open it, and then you can access behind the kennels.
Yeah. So where the ammo can boxes are on the front of the deck system, they sit just behind that, so I can still access those because that's where I store shells and stuff and all those. And then I have the 3 kennels across the center, ratcheted, strapped down, and then I have all the storage in the back still.
5.5 foot bed or 6.5?
5.5 foot.
5.5. Okay.
Yep. In the winter now, I actually stack 2 intermediate rufflings behind my driver's seat inside the cab now.
Okay, just to have them inside.
So I still have the 3 rufflings in the back, and then I have now 2 inside. So I could essentially fit 5 dogs in my truck right now.
You have 2 intermediates on the same side right behind the driver's seat, 1 on top of the other.
Yeah, stacked up. Yeah, 1 on top of the other.
Okay, gotcha. So, I'm asking because, well, the listeners will know I've been looking at trucks, and I have an SUV, and I'm probably going to have 3 dogs here within the next year and a new truck at some point, which is probably gonna be a truck with a topper. And we've done some interviews on sort of like overland camping setups and truck stuff. And I get tons of feedback on everybody loves the truck and the rig. And cause I think it's obviously we all have to kind of figure out the way that works best for us. But, that's good. That's good to know. You can get 3 kennels in there with the deck system. And yeah,
with the F-150 too, I like it because the dogs can sleep in the bed. And when I go on trips, North Dakota, South Dakota, Kansas, whatever, the driver's seat lays flat. So I'm able to just sleep in the truck instead of having to shimmy kennels around and sleep in the topper or set up a tent. I'm able to just lay the seat back, throw a pillow up and sleep right in the truck. So it makes it a little bit more easier than having to find hotels or anything. Like you guys talked about on your last one of your last podcasts, I have a fiberglass topper. So ever since that podcast, I've been trying to figure out how I can fit a rooftop tent on top of it.
Again, I don't know this because I haven't looked into it enough, but are there like some fiberglass toppers that, and I don't know if you know, but that have, because you can get, you know, you can put roof racks up on some of them and put canoes and stuff up there, but does it really have to be rated for a rooftop tent? I don't even know.
Yeah, so what I was seeing is a lot of guys will put supports across the center inside, like aluminum supports.
Okay.
And then they'll do their roof rack that goes from the topper to the on top of the truck as well, on top of the cab.
Yeah.
And then that's able to support enough weight. That's what I've came up with. After
like put a full rack up there.
Yeah, okay. All the way across. So
okay, I had a few people, that was with Jimmy Lewis, the last episode we did, that I had a few people reach out. Some people have the smart cap toppers, like Jimmy does. There was somebody emailed me and said they bought a, I don't even know if I have the link to this, but he bought a smart cap like topper off Alibaba, like the wholesale website that was like, it was very similar. He sent me a picture of it. I mean, it looked very similar. Who knows if it's like pirated, made in the same factory. I don't know, but he said it was a lot less expensive. So that's maybe a place to check out if somebody's looking for that. But I'm still got to figure out the truck first, but I've only been casually looking at caps and toppers, and I've hunted out of friends' trucks that have the deck system. I've never really had a drawer system. I haven't had a need to, but kind of thinking about that. Those ammo cans are on, they're like right on the side, right? Like the in front of the wheel wells on the sides of the truck.
Yeah, so I have the older deck system. I'm not sure about the newer one, but that's where the tie down for, or not tie down, where you secure the top or the deck system to the cab. So in the cab or in the box, there's a little D-ring and you use a clamp and secure it down. So yeah, so it's in all four corners because that's where it's secured down, but it's a lot more storage too. Like I said, I have in one of them, it's all my cleaning supplies. So gloves, knives, Ziploc bags. And then the other one's ammo. The other one's tie down straps and tow hooks. And the other one is just empty, but it opens up a lot more storage.
Sounds like a nice setup and one that probably many people listening have as well. It's we got to figure out how to tote those dogs and guns and everything around. So, yep. Do you have kennel covers or anything? Do you do anything this time of year for the ones that are under the cap? Do you have the Mud River kennel covers or anything like that?
Yeah. So with the Mud Rivers, I have two of those, but I can't fit three kennels in the back, which right now doesn't really matter for me, but
right.
I have two of those Mud Rivers. And then I have the military surplus, those wool blankets.
Yeah.
When it's really cold, I'll throw those over and cover the front vent too, or
yeah,
the door. And then have one of those on each side or inside each kennel. They still seem to be warm in there. You close all the vents, and if it's sunny out, the sun heats it up in there, and they're perfectly fine.
So when you have the Mud Rivers on, you can't get three because it's too tight, right?
Yeah, I can't get three across. I can probably do it the long way if I really wanted to, but
yeah, I was gonna. I know other people that stack them that way because if you have the window on the side, you can kind of let the dogs out. Have you ever run it like that?
That's how I started doing it, and then I realized I could fit three across in the front. And this is when we were going out to the North Dakota trip. We could fit three across, and then still have the cooler in the back and access the cooler behind the kennels, and then all the camping stuff on the other side. So it's all out of the way when we're hunting. We don't have to worry about that stuff. It's all in the back. And then up front, we have the face of the kennels, and then the deck drawer, we had all our guns and gainers and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, that's pretty, my buddy and I that I went to North Dakota with, he has a 6.5 foot bed in his truck. So we were not cramped for space with just two guys, but we ran the kennels across like that right near the tailgate and then used behind for storage. That's pretty slick to be able to do that and just have that stuff out of the way. And then you're not doing a bunch of unloading and rearranging and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. The only thing that I want to do next year, especially for North Dakota, is have a pressurized water tank in the back. You can get those little jugs and you can just pump air into them. Because instead of having to pull jugs out all the time, I like to just have a jug of water behind the kennels and then just have a hose come off that side. That's pretty much the only thing that I need to figure out before next year. So
that would be good because you always got to kind of have a water jug handy. What I've never really looked at those, like what kind of a tank volume wise would something like that be?
5 to 8 gallon tank generally, which they're out there that'll last us 2 days, maybe 3 days.
You just like pump it up?
The ones that I've seen, it's like a bike pump you screw on essentially and you pressurize it. Then you have a hose, like a 1/4 inch hose coming out with a little nozzle on, and it's just able to dump water out. So you don't have to like pick out the kennels or move a kennel or have the water jugs behind it, because that was the biggest hassle for us this year. Early season and out in North Dakota and stuff is water management, being able to have the jugs of water moving around, being able to let dogs out and stuff. So
yeah, if you got 3 kennels in front, you don't have the room for the water jug, but early season sharptail hunting, you need water. So yeah.
I've also seen like ballasts that they fill up, water ballasts for like wakeboards and stuff. They make smaller ones that I was thinking about securing to the top of the kennels and then just having a water ballast on top of the kennels, and then the same thing.
You still have some clearance above the kennels and the
probably
top
like
there.
5 inches. So you'd get like one of those small like ballasts.
Container.
And you can get, like 3 feet by 4 feet water ballast, and you can just fill it up with water. And yeah.
I've never seen anybody use anything like that, but it sounds like that'd be pretty handy just to have the hose and your tank somewhere where you're not taking up valuable space.
It's going to be the project for this summer, is try to figure out the best way for that to happen.
Yep. Always got to be working on something. I love it.
Yep.
Well, awesome, man. You're just going to be hunting pheasants as much as you can the rest of the year. You got any other trips or anything crazy? Do you get back down to Arizona at all?
I haven't since I left. I'd like to. Quail numbers this year aren't phenomenal or anything. We're thinking, my buddy who's still in the Navy, who's coming down this weekend, we try to do one big trip a year. So this year, I think we might be doing Kansas, depending on his schedule. He got a new job. He's a drill instructor for the Navy up in Iowa, or Chicago area, whatever that base is called. So his timeline this year hasn't been too conducive to be able to get that trip done, but hopefully later in the season, we're able to go down and maybe shoot a bobwhite, because I don't think he has shot a wild bobwhite yet. And that's his last quail that he needs, because he lived out in California for a long time and hunted all those quail, and then Arizona for a long time. So he's got all those. He just needs a wild bobwhite. So we're hoping this year we'll be able to get that down in Kansas for him. So,
all right, buddy. Well, this has been fun. I'm glad you and I had the chance to connect, and you already invited me down there, so I appreciate that. We'll have to do a hunt swap, and we got all the more reason now you can watch my English setters run and make a fool of themselves on pheasants.
That'd be perfect.
Do you have a favorite shotgun?
I was shooting a CZ Woodcock 20 gauge.
What's the CZ Woodcock? Is that an over-under?
It's off the Drake frame, but it's case colored, and then now I switched to a CZ Sharptail, single trigger, side-by-side, 28 gauge. Switch to that. Still running Boss Legacy 6s. Haven't had a problem killing pheasants yet. I had 2 old guys tell me I'm dumb that to shoot a 28 gauge late season for pheasants. I'm like, I'm putting them down. You guys are shooting 12 gauges and lugging those big guns around, but it's still working for me. If it stops working, I'll switch over to a 20 gauge, but until it stops working, it's what I'm going to run. It's nice and light.
Pick your shots. You can, 28 gauge is plenty capable, but you got to know your limits. Yep.
And then they're lab guys, so the birds are flushing way out in front of them. They're not walking up on points.
All right, buddy. Well, I really do appreciate you taking the time to join us on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. It was fun to connect with you, and wish you the best of luck this season. And thanks for joining us today, man.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. Hope you come down soon.
Appreciate it, buddy. Hey, everyone. It's your host, Nick, here. One more thing before you go. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes to this episode. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I will send you some of these Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you for doing so. Thanks, everyone. Catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.